Hello and welcome to Blogosphere Serious Influence, the podcast all about the business side of the influencer industry. I'm Alice Audley and I'm the founder of Blogosphere, which hopefully you've heard of. But if not, Blogosphere is a media company rooted in the world of influencers. We run events, an influencer network, and publish a nationally distributed print magazine, and now a podcast too, which I'll be presenting. If there are any questions about the influencer industry that you want answered, be sure to tweet us your suggestions. Our Twitter handle is @blogosphereM. And if you want to learn more about influencers and the influencer industry, be sure to visit blogosphere magazine.com and invest in a subscription to our essential magazine. We're excited to announce that Series 1 of Serious Influence has an exclusive sponsor, the smart thinking money app, Yolt. Yolt is an app that I personally use, so I'm delighted to partner with them. You can sync your accounts, credit cards, and pensions in one view and track your spending habits, how much you're spending and what you're spending it on. I buy a lot of coffee. Yolt takes the stress out of budgeting and gives you the tools to achieve your financial life goals. For me, that's a trip to French Polynesia. Download Yolt for free from the App Store or Google Play Store today. Today on Blogosphere Serious Influence, I'm joined by Philip Trippenbach. Philip is the head of influencer marketing at Edelman, where he has worked on an array of influencer campaigns, including Steve Booker's pole-to-pole expedition with PayPal. Although Philip is now a staple voice on the influencer industry, he started off his professional life as a journalist.
Well, originally I was a journalist. That's how I started my career in journalism. I'm Canadian. I'm from Montreal. I studied international politics and economics and sustainable development, and then I went into journalism. And I started working at the CBC in Canada. This was when I was in my early 20s. And after that, I made the move to the United Kingdom. I moved to London in January of 2005. I was with the BBC from about 2006 until 2011. And I was working in the current affairs department there.
So how did you move from the current affairs department of the BBC into head of influencer marketing at Edelman?
The entire direction of my career took a huge turn when I was at the BBC because 2006, this was the pre-Cambrian explosion of social media.
Yeah.
Right. So back then it was MySpace, it was Bebo, it was Friendster, it was, you know, all this kind of stuff. The BBC was just like frothing with the question of what do we do online? What do we do online as a public service broadcaster? Should Panorama have a Twitter account? You know, should Watchdog have a Twitter account? So the current affairs department at the BBC is the one that does all of the documentary style programs, including Panorama, except for Newsnight. Newsnight is its own thing. So it's not news, but it's like longer form documentaries. And so there I was doing stuff like doing research on fake passports for a documentary called My Fake Passports and Me, a whole bunch of documentary series that I was doing research on, and actually started developing interactive there.
And so what kind of year then are we in when you're leaving the BBC and going, what's your next step?
I took a job after I left the BBC as the editor-in-chief of an online journalism startup called CitizenSide. It sounded like a fantastic idea to me at the time. There was a variety of differences of opinion between me and the leadership at the time. So in the end, I just took a job at Edelman.
So you go from startup to one of the biggest PR companies and institutions in the world.
Yeah, I suppose.
What was that transition like?
Hellish. After a career as a journalist, I, for the first time in my life, was exposed to the idea of working for a client, right? Edelman as an agency has clients.
Yeah.
And this was a very new concept for me because as a journalist, you don't have clients, right? You produce a piece of content to the best of your abilities and it goes out. I mean, you have an editor who gives comments on that, but that's a very different relationship from a client-agency relationship.
And what was your first job at Edelman? What was your title?
I joined as an account director in the digital team. And then I was not a specialist. So I joined as an account director in the digital team, and I was managing accounts such as Anglo American, a mining company, Qualcomm, that makes semiconductors for mobile phones and other chips for mobile phones and other such things, a whole bunch of other clients, Aviva. And we were doing things like running their social media accounts. We were doing things like giving them strategic advice on their online presence, a whole bunch of stuff like that. I transitioned from there into the strategy team, where I started doing more of actually what I found difficult at the beginning, is trying to understand what a client wants, what a client needs. And the way I think of it is, look, what is your business goal? whose head are you trying to get into? What communications goal do you need to achieve in order to achieve your business goal? Okay, so we know who you're trying to reach, what you want to make them think, feel, and do. Now let's work together on working out how we can achieve that. And so through the strategy team, I started doing more and more that type of stuff.
Yeah.
And that's how I got into the influencer game.
So what was the first experience that you had with influencers?
Well, the first experience that I had with influencers actually was with Shell. Shell is one of Edelman's largest clients, and they run a really cool initiative, which is called the Make the Future Festival. So Make the Future is a larger initiative, and then there is a Make the Future Live, which are sort of physical events. So Shell runs these events, and we were running the social media operation for those events. So creating the content and making sure that these events were as visible and having as much of an effect as they could. This would have been back in 2013, 2014. We started saying, well, listen, you guys are sending all these journalists to these events. Do you know what you really ought to do? You should start looking out for people on YouTube who are making cool videos about cars and engineering and start sending them to these events.
Were you at that time already watching people on YouTube, and were you personally aware of the movement as well? Were you engaging with them?
Yeah, absolutely. I was watching people on YouTube. You know, that's where this original idea came from. But at the time, it wasn't seen as influencer work. There wasn't a label for it. And I have a big problem with the label, by the way. So that's a separate a separate thing. So that was the first that we started working in a manner which now we would call influencer marketing. But that wasn't a substantive part of my work at the time. I was much more of a generalist. I shifted into the influencer specialism for a different reason, is because I saw what seemed to me an opportunity to drastically improve the effectiveness of our influencer work.
What did you see were the failings at that time?
A lack of understanding of what influence actually is.
And do you still face that today?
Every day. Absolutely. I think that there's a widespread conflation of popularity with influence. Oh, you've got 10 million followers, so you must be twice as influential as that person with 5 million followers. But that's just rubbish, right?
Yeah.
Influence doesn't work that way. And this is a very insidious misapprehension, because influencer payment is often indexed to number of followers, right? And then you get into the whole part of the difference between influencer marketing and influence. And we do influence at Edelman. Like, I'm running an influence practice. I'm not running an influencer marketing practice. Influencer marketing is a part of what we do, but it's a subset.
Yeah.
And I think that the focus on influencer marketing has quite rightly sparked a backlash, right? When you've got the likes of Keith Weed at Unilever speaking out against influencer fraud, when you've got studies coming out showing that I think something like nearly half of people are say they're getting tired of influencer marketing,
yeah,
they find it repetitive.
67% of marketing businesses are increasing their influencer marketing spend in the last year.
Right, right.
We're going to see more of that. So it obviously is working, but I think we are in, it's sort of
murky.
I don't
know if it's working.
Oh, really?
I don't know if it's working. I mean, it depends on what campaign you look at, and it depends on how you're measuring how it's working.
What are the metrics that you're finding that your clients want? I mean, to concentrate on influencers, obviously it's kind of influence versus influencer marketing, but how do you define the value of an influencer to a client? Is that a battle that you do have?
Yeah, sure. And you know, we get asked constantly, what's going to be the ROI on my influencer work? To which my answer is, well, if you're coming to me because you want to sell more of this particular product, then I'm going to try and steer you away from influencer work to begin with. I don't think that that kind of influencer work ought to happen. The hashtag ad, hey, here's me with this shiny new thing, right? I think that there's a very narrow niche for that in influencer world. And very often that is actually net negative for the brand.
Do you think that we're coming out of that, though, and we are seeing less just pure product placement ads, and we're actually seeing brands develop longer term, more cohesive partnerships with influencers now? And is that what you think that brands should be doing? And also, just to go back to your point on return on investment, when they're coming to you saying, what is it? Do they even know most of the time what they want? Have they even told you what deliverables? Is it sales? Is it brand sentiment?
Yeah, there's a huge range of sophistication among clients. Some of our clients are very sophisticated, and some of our clients less so. Look, you mentioned earlier the rise in budgets for influencer marketing, and I don't think that's unjustified. But I think that in order for practitioners in this space to really get a return on the budgets that they're pouring into this, they need to approach it in the right way, and they need to really know what they're getting into. And I think that there's a few big misunderstandings. So I've already mentioned the correlation of popularity with influence. I think the second one is the adoption of an advertising mindset. And this is a big, big problem, because the way that advertising works, right, is that you have a stream of content, say a TV show, and you interrupt that content with advertising.
Yeah.
Right? And a lot of what I see in terms of influencer work done poorly seems to come from that attitude, right? You can almost, you know, hear the gears turning in somebody's head and look at a piece of influencer content and go, Kylie Jenner, or one of the Kardashians has X million followers and she's, you know, tweeting this stream of content. Let's interrupt that with a piece on our product, you know, our slimming tea, right? It's almost stereotypical how much that has been maligned, right? And you look at that and you're like, well, this is patently rubbish because that's just not authentic. You can see that it's not really connected to who that person is.
I think reality influencers are much more guilty of that.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And I think that there's, you know, something interesting happens when popularity entrains its own popularity, right?
Yeah.
Like everybody follows PewDiePie because everybody follows PewDiePie. You know, there's some sort of critical mass that you reach, right? Where you start acquiring followers just because you have a lot of followers.
Well, this is kind of what you were saying earlier when people are, and in terms of budgets, someone has X million amount of followers, so the money is linked directly to that, but they're actually not as engaged because they are following for the follow.
Right, right. Here we get into the ongoing problem of influencer typology. Because yes, you know, so you've got your celebrities from reality TV or from movies or from wherever who have now acquired big online followings. You've got your micro-influencers. You've got your micro-micro-influencers. I don't know, right? Like, here actually is why we said, okay, this is rubbish. None of the approaches actually ladder up to any coherent view of influence as a whole. We need to address this. And at the end of 2015 and through 2016, that's what I did. So I developed RARA, which is the four-dimensional system of influencer measurement that we use at Edelman. And RARA stands for relevance, authority, reach, and accessibility. And in my view, these are the four dimensions of influence. And through adopting this method, we are able to sidestep entirely the unproductive debate about celebrities versus micro-influencers versus brand advocates versus whatever. No, if you just think about the four dimensions, actually, we have a quantified, rigorous methodology that can actually help us understand influence and approach it in a way that is more structured and delivers better results. There's a dissonance here in the market between, on the one hand, influencer fees being indexed somehow to the number of followers they have, but the number of followers not adequately reflecting what a person's true influence is, which is why there are three other dimensions. So relevance. Is this person actually on topic, right? Marcus Butler is a great influencer. He creates super content. But, you know, if you look at his audience composition, right, I would not want to get Marcus Butler to try and recommend a motor oil, for example, right? Even though he's got millions and millions of followers. He's not relevant to that audience, to that topic. He's also not authoritative in that topic, right? So would you take advice from Marcus Butler or this dude who runs a YouTube channel that you've never heard of before who has 500 followers, but he's a mechanic? Well, you know, that sounds like maybe that's a higher authority channel, right? And then the last dimension, accessibility. Can we work with this person? Which is, you know, money is a factor there, right? So with a system like this, and especially since we've developed a method to quantify the system, we can actually show our clients, look, we can measure the authority, we can measure the relevance, we can measure the reach, and not just in terms of total followers, but in terms of how many members of your target audience, 16 to 24-year-old females or whatever it is, are listening to this person on a 30-day basis, on a 90-day basis, then we can actually have a good idea of what the position of this person is in the influence landscape, and then we can start talking about goals, then we can start talking about costs, then we can start talking about budgets.
So with RARA, is that a sort of manual process? It's not all automated. How does the kind of back end?
We started that as a manual process, but actually now we've developed software that allows us to score these in a semi-automated way. We have access to a lot of data from the social web that allows us to build initial calculations for most of the dimensions. Reach, obviously, you know, we can pull that off of the APIs of the various monitoring systems that we use. Relevance through keyword matching and other manners. Authority through a whole bunch of inputs. We can calculate base scores for these. But the critical piece that's missing, if it was just machine calculations, is the expertise of the brand specialists and the communications specialists that I work with. And so what we do is we also incorporate data from a questionnaire. We say, okay, here's an influencer. Now, on a scale of 1 to 7, how would you rate this? How would you rate that? How would you rate that? And through a series of a few questions like this, we can arrive at a quantified score for relevance, authority, and accessibility, which incorporates machine intelligence and human intelligence and draws a composite score.
Do you think that in the future, this market could ever be 100% automated?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. I mean, you know,
because it is such a personal touch, it is different from, you know, it's not a straight media buy. I mean, what are your views on that in terms of sort of the micro influencer platforms that are kind of treating influencers as a straight media buy? I mean, actually, you wrote a blog post about this, that it shouldn't be seen as a kind of influencer marketing. It should be influencer strategy because they are people.
But here we're talking about a mix of online and offline influencers, people who can be engaged in a multiple different ways. People who can be engaged on social media to create content, yes, but also people who can be invited to events, and maybe people who organize events that Shell could participate in or that members of Shell could join or discuss, right? This is about information flowing through people. This is about social connections. That's what really makes information flow. That's what really makes the world change. It's social relationships between people. The social point is so important because, you know, earlier I was mentioning the advertising approach. Advertising is based on interrupting content. And for me, the most important thing about influencers is that it's not a content relationship. It's a social relationship, right? Just because a social relationship is tenuous doesn't mean that it's not real. So, you know, if you're looking at somebody like PewDiePie, right, that's not like a TV show being broadcast to 60 million people. That is 60 million one-to-one connections. Because if I go to PewDiePie's YouTube channel and I type in a comment, you know, maybe he'll answer me, right? There's a chance, right? There's a two-way channel. The channel is open. He probably won't because I'm one of 60 million. But just because a social relationship is tenuous doesn't mean it's not real. Imagine if I were to interrupt this podcast recording, right, to say, look, full disclosure, hashtag ad, but I get £50 a week from Samsung, you know, and let me just pull my mobile out here, right? And let me just tell you about how amazing this phone is.
Yeah.
And I'll give you a discount code when we leave the recording room, right? That would be totally inappropriate and weird, right?
But then Samsung do it quite well with their Casey Neistat partnership.
Yes, but that's not about featuring the product as such.
Exactly.
Right? That's about authentically expressing the brand values through a person who shares those values. And so there's no inauthenticity there. That's what influencer work is actually about. It's about finding people who have personal values that are aligned with the brand values and then enabling them to do something better, right? I'll tell you a really good story. Campaign end to end.
Great.
Client, PayPal. Target, 20 to 30 year olds, UK, France, Germany. Objective. PayPal wants these people to know that PayPal isn't just for buying stuff on eBay, that you can use PayPal in real life. You could buy a coffee with PayPal. You could buy flights with PayPal. You could, you know, you could do stuff in real life. So we went away and we did some research. And this campaign was actually run by my colleague, Nick Robinson. And research comes back saying, well, you know what? The audience that you're looking for, these young people in UK, France, and Germany, first of all, they're really not interested in personal finance. So that's a bit of a problem for PayPal. Secondly, when it does come to buying stuff, they're not that interested in buying stuff. If they do have money to spend, they prefer spending it on experiences. Okay, now we're getting somewhere. What is the experience that they want most of all? Travel. Okay, so we found a travel influencer called Steve Booker. And we organized what we think is the first cashless pole-to-pole journey. So we sent him up to Svalbard near the Arctic Circle. And then from there, he flew to Moscow. From Moscow, he flew to Barcelona, Cape Town. And he ended up at the end in Ushuaia, Tierra del Fuego, at the southern tip of South America. All the flights were paid for by PayPal. All of the accommodation was paid for by, not by PayPal, but through PayPal, yeah. Right? So he was staying and flying and traveling with people. And when he was in Svalbard, he went dog sledding, and it was a dog sled tour operator who accepted PayPal, right? And in South Africa, Cape Town, he went on a gyrocopter flight, and it was, you know, they accepted PayPal, right? So here you have, right, the brand as enabler. The PayPal pole-to-pole, you know, it's still up there. You can see the videos, right? It's a 9-part.
I've watched it. It's good.
It's, right, cool. Okay, and it's what I would have called in my BBC days. It's good TV. You know, it's watchable, right? It's an interesting travel log. And what it does is it takes the brand values of convenience, of security, of enabling, and it elevates the content. You know, Steve at the time would never have been able to go on a trip like that without the support of a sponsor, but it was expressed in a way that was authentic to him. And it wasn't, hey, everybody, hashtag ad, here's PayPal. No, the whole thing was called PayPal pole to pole. It couldn't have been more boldly announced that it was a brand-sponsored thing, but it was real. It was authentic to him. It elevated his contact with his followers, his social contact with his followers.
So what do you see as the point of these third-party platforms for micro-influencers particularly?
Let me be blunt.
You haven't shied away so far, Philip.
Okay. Let me be blunt. The platforms are doomed. They have no future. Because with the functionality that Facebook is bringing in right now, there is no future for influencer platforms. Here we're talking about the intermediaries, the interplayers, the influencer marketplaces, right?
Yeah.
Not a chance. Because now, through the functionality that Facebook is putting in place, if I'm a brand manager, I can actually find influencers on Instagram and on Facebook through Facebook, right? So this is already out in a prototype stage in the US. It's coming to the rest of the world very quickly. Why would I use an intermediary when I can go directly to Facebook and say, I want to reach 18 and 19-year-olds who are about to start university within a 200-kilometer radius of the following 7 cities, who are into fishing? That's the kind of segmentation that is going to be possible there very soon.
So Facebook will enable agencies to be able to find those people. So there's still the role. What is the role of an agency? That still has, it's the middlemen. Because in terms of the flow of money, I mean, one example, a French brand wants to spend $100,000 on influencer marketing, on a macro influencer campaign. That influencer will actually only get £30,000. But then that influencer has management who take a 20% fee. Mm-hmm. So the influencer gets £24,000. And then you've got three people in the middle who are just pushing briefs across to each other. And then they're doing a 40% markup each time. And that's how you get back to your 100,000.
Well, first of all, good strategy is worth money. Because it's a big leap, right, from, like in the PayPal example that I mentioned, it's a big leap from, hey, we want more 20 to 30-year-olds to use PayPal on a day-to-day basis to PayPal pole-to-pole. There's a lot of creativity. There's a lot of strategy that goes into that. And that's worth something, I should think. So that, I think, is going to continue to be the role of the agency.
And that helps with brand safety, because I suppose that's one of the biggest concerns, would you say?
Brand safety is definitely a concern.
What do you think are the biggest challenges and concerns at the moment? I know that you mentioned Keith Weed coming out at Unilever saying, trust, if it's not sorted out soon, then it's going to be done forever. I mean, in the same within the influencer...
I wouldn't go that far. I think that while I think that there's no doubt that influencer work and the nature of influencer work is going to change profoundly, influence is never going to go away, right? Because of the primary importance of influence to just humans and how we interact, you know, the fact that it's expressed on Instagram now and whatever platform comes next, you know, 5 or 10 years from now, those are details. The core challenge remains, how can you take a brand communications challenge and turn it into a story that works for an influencer, that works for their audience, and that gets a brand message across in a way that makes everybody happy and that doesn't feel like an interruption, that doesn't feel like an imposition.
Do you think, obviously, Facebook are launching their own platform, but fewer people are kind of signing up to Facebook now? I mean, you joined in 2007, I joined in 2006. I used to update every day writing on people's walls. Mm-hmm. Now it's only huge kind of life moments that I'll be putting on my personal Facebook. Mm-hmm. Instagram, on the other hand, you know, everybody is on there all the time. But we've seen platforms come and go. So if there is an actual objective platform that can help facilitate these direct relationships between influencers and management and agencies, then maybe that does have a place.
Well, I suppose. But I think that to a great degree, Facebook's move in this area are them trying to move exactly into that space. I think that Snapchat has been in a problematic position from the point of view of agencies for a while because of the complete lack of metrics that they've made available. Now they've just changed that. So I think that now that we, you know, in the agency and the brand and the communications industry world have access to an idea of how well that content is doing, now maybe Snapchat is going to be something that we focus on a little bit more. But previously we haven't looked at it, mostly because we were unable to give our client any kind of indication of, you know, what they got for their money. Whereas on all the other platforms, we can say, well, look, here's our engagement rate, number of engagements. You know, we can look at click-throughs if that's appropriate for the campaign. Now, if we can start going to that way with Snap, then we'll be in a good place.
What do you think is the most powerful platform in terms of influencers? A YouTube video, an Instagram post, maybe Instagram TV? Although I don't know if that's got the metrics yet.
Influence is about people, and people are influential in different areas. So I think that looking at it from the point of view of a powerful platform, in my mind, is looking through the wrong end of the telescope. It's about
what do you find clients are wanting, though, when they come to you and they say, we have this idea, this is the people that we want to reach. Do you, you know, is Instagram first and foremost what people are wanting at the moment? There must be the appetite.
Yeah. In a product-related B2C approach, Instagram is usually, you know, front of mind. But I mean, look, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube really are the three platforms that we work on the most for most of our clients. Those all three in a B2C vein, and then LinkedIn for a B2B vein as well.
And you say when the client comes and they have their budget, the influencer marketing is only a part of what your strategy is as a whole. But what is the kind of revenue split on the budget? How much, you know, is it a third? Is it half that goes to influencers on a normal kind of campaign? And I know that you don't want to mention specific brands and their spend, but how much money is coming through on a kind of scale for a big campaign?
Right. So on a typical brand marketing where it's a B2C play for eventually building brand affinity with a product that you can buy, influencer fees will be a significant component of our budget. Yes.
Okay, I've got £100,000. How much would go to the influencer part in this scenario?
There's so much variation there that I can't answer that question to any degree of precision.
Variation on whether it's, say you're using macro influencers. I don't know, it's just, there must be a sliding scale here.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the sliding scale?
I mean, anything from 10 to 50%, okay. Maybe even higher. If we're doing an activation where it's a very targeted, okay, we've narrowed it down. One influencer, we already have a relationship with them, and we're charging on an hour's basis to a client, then the lion's share of the fee could go to the influencer, because how long does it take us to negotiate and set up a contract and all the rest of that on an hour's basis compared to how much an influencer might charge? Somebody with 10 million followers, 15 million followers, you know, that's serious money. If we already have a relationship with their agent and we know them, we've worked with them before, which often is the case, then on a charging by hours basis, our take of that could be quite minimal.
Do you see that split increasing in an influencer's favor in future from what you're hearing back from clients at the moment?
What do you mean?
So, you know, anything from 10 to 50%, but do you think that that's going to increase in the future because more people want to allocate part of that budget specifically to influencers as opposed to the other things that you're putting within the strategy? And do you think that that's a good idea? Do you think people are falling in a bubble of...
Okay, well, I think that trying to do influencer work without good strategic advice is asking for trouble. And I'm not saying that a client needs to go to an agency for that, because they may have good strategic advice in-house, in which case, fantastic. But I would want to be sure that I'm structuring my message the right way, that I'm actually engaging with the right influencers. How do you pick them? That's a very difficult question. There are a lot of variables, and that's why we use our four-dimensional system of influence, is because it helps us make sure that we're picking the right ones for our client.
What's the worst campaign that you've seen?
I think if you have to use hashtag ad, you've failed. And I know that legally you're required to do so because the partnership with the brand needs to be clear.
Declared, yeah.
Right? But I think that if you're doing your work right, you shouldn't need to use hashtag ad because either the partnership with the brand should be so obvious, as in the PayPal poll-to-poll case, that there's no need for further disclosure. Or
what are the rules surrounding that, though? So you would still need to be putting the hashtag ad to fit with the ASA's guidelines.
Yeah, sure, sure.
What are your views on the ASA as well? Where do you think we are in terms of disclosure?
Well, I think that the ASA is approaching influencer marketing in a very sensible manner. I think that it's entirely fair and ethically sound that people should be aware of the fact that they're watching a piece of content that's been influenced by a brand that's got an interest, you know, beyond just creating good content. So absolutely. But I think that, you know, if you look at why those rules have come into place, it's often because of product level marketing that was executed, you know, basically in a deceptive manner, mostly through ignorance, not through malice, but, you know, through omission rather than commission, but still in a deceptive manner in the lack of clarity around the brand partnerships.
Where do you see the influencer market going in the next 12 months?
In the next 12 months. Well,
if you can go as far as 5 years, that would be great. But people seem to struggle with that question because it changes so rapidly.
Well, I think that all of the influencer platforms in 5 years are going to be dead. I really do not see a future for them. Why would you go to a third party when you can go directly to the source, to Facebook, to Instagram, and segment your audience that way and reach out to influencers that way?
And still be able to scale.
Yeah. There's nothing there. There's no reason for them to exist. The only thing that's going to continue to add value in influencer work is strategic influencer guidance on the right influencers to engage and how to structure a brand message to make sure that it engages the right influencers and reaches the right audience effectively.
Do you feel that you're having these conversations that you've just had with me with other members of the industry? Do you think there's enough communication from agency to agency about this specific market?
No. No.
Why do you think that is?
I think that because of the rapidly rising budgets that you mentioned earlier, there is a great deal of competitiveness between the agencies here. And I've not made any efforts and I've not been approached by any of my peers at any other agencies to start discussing or having the kind of conversation that we're having here.
So there's an influencer, they have management, a brief comes through and they respond to different agencies creating the same amount of content and the same workload that goes in, but pricing it very differently.
Oh, yeah. Well, so there's a lot of issues with that. I mean, we manage that internally because we've got a global database of influencers called Starview. And it's an IRM, like a CRM, but for influencer relationship management system. So we try and get around the cost issue by making sure that anybody who's ever had contact with any influencer is logging it to that database. And so, you know, that stops influencers from charging, say, the San Francisco office one price and the London office another price a week later for something similar. But I think there's a bigger issue in that. I've started to see that there's actually a fee differential between male influencers and female influencers. I mean, first of all, the influencer landscape in terms of pros, right? People, you know, who classically influencers, people who make their money from brand partnerships, seems to be overwhelmingly male from what I've said. I mean, if you look at the top 100 YouTubers, last I counted, I think 80 of them were white and men for YouTube, right? Which is, why would that be the case? And I'm starting to see that there's a differential between how much a female influencer charges for a piece of content and how much a male influencer charges for a similar piece of content.
And what is that? Is this pay gap again?
Well, it is a pay gap.
Yeah.
And the pay gap skews towards the men.
Or so men are charging more.
Men are charging more. The problem with this is that, you know, I say that there seems to be because, you know, what is the same piece of content, right?
Yeah.
Well, is you know, is a 10-minute YouTube video and a tweet the same as like a 3-minute YouTube video and 12 tweets?
There must be an example, though, of someone that has done exactly the same, you know, 10-minute video, tweet, Instagram story, Instagram on a male and female basis.
Well, and that's why this issue has come to my attention, is because I started seeing that, wait a minute. Like, you know, this is a tough one, right? Because our job as the agent here, the agency counseling a client, is to obtain the best deal for our client. So we negotiate hard with these people, right? Well, usually we negotiate hard with their agents, their management, right? So I'd call it a squishy system because it's not like a demand goes in and there's a response. Actually, there's an influencer setting expectations with his or her management. The management is talking to our negotiators and we are talking to the client. And there's a lot of friction in those points of connection. But we don't have enough information yet to see if there is an actual systemic problem in terms of influencer compensation. This is just my sort of gut feeling based on the data that I've seen processed in an entirely sort of, you know, wetware subconscious way.
And is that a problem for you in a business sense, or is that moral?
No, it's a moral problem. It's an ethical problem. I mean, look, from a business sense, I could care less, right? From a business sense, it's like, I don't care. I want to push those influencer fees down as low as possible, but
so
that's
just
not fair.
What are you going to do about it?
Well, first of all, we're collecting data and we're monitoring because we need to make sure that this problem is real. That's the stage that we're at right now. But I definitely think that the industry as a whole has a moral responsibility to find out if influencers are being treated fairly.
And do you think that influencers know or are aware of this?
Well, I mean, as far as I know, you know, how much should I be paid is a frequent question at any influencer gathering. And as far as I know, it's the Wild West out there. And since influencers continue to be paid indexed by their following, see, that's a real problem, right? Because if you look at it from a client's perspective, a high relevance, high authority influencer is worth more to them than a high reach influencer, especially since reach is functionally irrelevant, right? We can buy reach. I don't care if you've got 5 million followers. If I can find somebody who's got 500 followers but is perfect for this creative activation, I can put paid behind her content to reach as many people as I want.
Speaking of, you can buy reach and you can buy followers, do you have vetting processes in place, and how big a problem do you think fraudulent accounts are at the moment?
You mean like numbers of fraudulent followers?
I
think numbers of fraudulent followers are a big problem. You know, the likes of Keith Weed wouldn't be talking about it otherwise, but they've come from a system-wide misunderstanding of what influence is. Because if you're in the headspace where you think that somebody with 2 million followers is twice as influential as somebody with 1 million followers, then there's a huge incentive for that person to buy followers to jack up their rates. But the number of people who decided at one point in history to click subscribe on your content, that's what a follower count is. And that means nothing to how influential you actually are. You know, the most influential people in something like the shift to electric cars, you know, have relatively tiny followings, but they're committed. They drive the discussion. They actually push culture forward. That's very different from somebody with 10 million followers who's, you know, not
those 10 million followers who have been around for 10 years.
Yeah.
I think we're coming into second generation influencer as well now, because, you know, in the first generation, it was very much starting and just posting to social media and they didn't really know that it was going to be a career. Mm. But now you've got people starting that do know that it can be a proper vocation.
Yeah. And I have so little time for those people.
The second generation.
Yeah. And I'm sorry, I'm being very rude here. I know. But look, if you're trying to be an influencer, don't. You've misunderstood what it's about. Yes, there's a niche for people who are famous because they're famous and they're online famous and they get deals from companies. But look, that's fake. It's not authentic. And it misunderstands what influence is actually about.
So your advice would be share your passion, tell your story. And if influence comes as a result of that, then great.
Yeah, it will. If you're good enough at it, it will. Whatever you're interested in, if you're interested in sound engineering, if you're interested in fly fishing, and you have a knack for creating good content that brings that passion to life, influence will follow in that specific area. But look, you know, everybody's an influencer, right? I'm influential with a small group of people about influencer marketing because they follow me on LinkedIn. I don't know, but, you know, it's a tiny group, right? You're influential about influencer marketing because of the people who talk to and follow you. But influence is complex. It's topic dependent. I'm not influential about, you know, hair care.
You've predicted what will happen in terms of influencer platforms over the next few years. Where would you like to see your job going?
Oh, boy. Well, let me tell you where I think that the industry is going. I think that everything is maturing. And I think that what we're seeing now is a move towards enterprise-level global influencer management systems. So
it's a mouthful. Yeah. Can you say that once more?
Enterprise-level global influencer management systems. So let me tell you, you know, we have clients like big global brands, right? Shell, the various Unilever brands, you know, loads of companies like that that have offices all around the world and that have influencer operations are starting to incorporate influencer operations into their global marketing mix. So here's a challenge. How do you incorporate the need for local insight with the need for global coherency? Because there's no way that I'm going to pick up a phone to an influencer based in Bangkok and know which to talk to. I mean, you know, even if I spoke the language, I don't have enough immersion in the culture to be able to give any kind of recommendations on who to work with and how to co-create content and all the rest of that. That needs to be done from Thailand in that case. But on the other hand, if I'm a global brand, I want to make sure that my influencer operations all around the world are at least coherent in terms of the brand messaging and the approach and, you know, the ethics of it and disclosure and all the rest of that. Well, there's a role for an agency like ours. And that's this kind of stuff that we're starting to do now, is we're starting to say, okay, client, you've run 18 different influencer operations in 10 different markets over the course of the past year. They're all separated. You know, the influencer contact lists are like in Excel files on people's desktops somewhere. Okay, so there's a technical task to unify all that into a coherent database. And then there's a strategic task of like planning a global influencer strategy in a way that actually makes sense for a global brand, but retains local relevance. And then there's a task in actually managing that in a coherent manner. So that's kind of where we're going in one way. Another way that we're going is in technology development. So first of all, we've already instantiated our four-dimensional influencer ranking technology in software. So we're starting to push that out. And as I mentioned earlier, it still has a human component, but it allows us to rank influencers much faster.
And is that just within Edelman or that software you will sort of syndicate to other brands?
We won't be marketing it on a software as a service process, no. So it's kind of like, it's an influencer power tool and we're the carpenter, if you see what I mean, right? So we can use
Edelman's that. USP, and when it comes, you know, if you want to know exactly which influencer over these quantifiable things, then go to Edelman. So it's a selling point.
Yeah, absolutely. What that software does, it's called Constellations. And what Constellations does is it allows us to give influencer recommendations to a client based on data. Because there's nothing more frustrating than you having picked the right influencer for a client and the client going, I don't like her. Well, okay, but we have data to show that this is the best person for your audience. So that's a different story. The other area that we're going into is deep influencer content analysis, including personality profiling. So we've actually developed a software system based on some artificial intelligence and machine learning APIs that allows us to analyze content posted by an influencer or indeed anybody and extract data about their personality type and their content needs and other such things. So we can actually tell by data whether a person has a personality type and values that are aligned with a brand value.
So Edelman itself is investing quite heavily in technology in the influencer space.
Absolutely. That's never going to supplant human judgment. It complements, it elevates human judgment. And what it means is that now, previously, right, when we were doing this kind of rah-rah influencer scoring on a manual basis, it used to take a very large team of analysts a lot of time to do that kind of stuff. Now, you know, it's much quicker because of the software, which means that we can deploy quantified influencer mapping to many, many more clients in a cost-effective manner. So it's win-win because more clients get the rigor of the data-based approach. And on the other hand, you know, we get to work with more clients on this kind of basis.
So you're enjoying your job and you're not going anywhere soon?
Something would have to be pretty outrageous to get me out of here right now.
Thank you very much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. This has been a pleasure.
A big thank you to Philip for coming on the show. You've been listening to Blogosphere, Serious Influence, with me, Alice Audley. Join us next week for a brand new episode. Until then, be sure to check out blogospheremagazine.com for influencer industry updates. And why not treat yourself to a magazine subscription whilst you're there?